todo el mundo.
But this was really
1981.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. I'm your host, Stacey Lane Wilson, author of the Rock and Roll Nightmares book series and director of the documentary The Ventures, Stars on Guitars. This is your destination for all things rock, where the interviewees include musicians, authors, historians, filmmakers, and more. And now, on to the show. Welcome to another episode of Rock and Roll Nightmares. I'm your host, Stacey Lane Wilson. On today's show, we have a special guest, Emmy Award-winning director, Andrew Wright. Andrew is here to discuss his new documentary, Born Innocent, The Red Cross Story, which premieres in theaters and nationwide on December the 5th of 2024. The film tells the wild, hilarious, and moving stories of two brothers from Southern California who started a band as preteens and have been on a 45-year rock and rollin' roller coaster ever since. It's a journey that's included encounters with David Bowie, David Cassidy, and Francis Ford Coppola, not to mention over a dozen drummers and even a kidnapping. So Andrew is here to tell us all about it. Welcome to the show. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Stacey. This is great.
Well, I absolutely loved your documentary, although I didn't know much about Red Cross to begin with. So I'm wondering what attracted you personally to make a documentary about them.
First of all, I have to say like that's the single thing I love hearing the most. I love it when people say that they like the movie and didn't know the band, because it was so my goal. It was just to make something that wasn't just fan service and for the hardcore fans, but that was just like fun and accessible to anyone, you know, who maybe hadn't heard a note or ever heard of them or doesn't even know anything about like the music scenes they come from. So that makes me feel great. So I've been a fan since I was in high school. I grew up in New Jersey, and I was like a punk rock, you know, like a sort of hardcore kid in New Jersey. And in like 83, 84, there was like one other punk kid in my school, and we just hatched this plan. The school had a radio station, and we were like, if we get our FCC licenses, we could get radio shows. And, you know, one, we could be like playing punk and hardcore, which no one was, you know, so few people were really playing on the radio at the time. But also we could get access to the radio station letterhead, and we can send away to all the record labels that we find and with fanzines and Maximum Rock and Roll or Flipside or whatever. And we could get free records. Like, that was really like what we were in for. And,
the swag. Yeah.
Yeah. And we did. We started doing that, and we started getting lots of free records. And one day this package came from a label called Gasatanker Records. And in it was the Teen Babes from Monsanto record by Red Cross, which is an EP of almost exclusively cover songs. But so there's covers of Kiss and you know, Deuce by Kiss and Citadel by the Rolling Stones and Savior Machine by David Bowie. And I, you know, but also like Heaven Only Knows by the Shangri-Las and a cover of this song from the TV show Bewitched. And it was very different from what my musical diet at the time was, which is all this super fast, like hard thrashy stuff, and but I loved it so much, and it really just was sort of this mind expanding record that made me think, maybe I should go back and listen to some of this more sort of like quote unquote classic rock stuff, which I just sort of skipped over because I got into punk rock so young. And there was something mysterious about the band. I knew they had come out of the punk rock scene, but the record didn't really, it had a sort of heavy punk edge to it, but it was also really melodic. And anyway, it just, I loved it, and it sort of turned me into a lifetime fan. Just they sort of kept evolving, but I loved every stage along the way. And when I moved to Los Angeles in the 90s, I finally really, I got to see them play, and they're just such an incredible live band. And there was, beyond that, reading interviews with them, Jeff and Steve McDonald, who are the only constants, the two brothers who formed the band, and a lot of other members have come and gone, but it's really, the movie's really this sort of Jeff and Steven McDonald story. I found them just really interesting, funny, charismatic characters. And then I heard Steve tell this insane story on a podcast about something that happened to him when he was like 12, 13 years old with this much older woman that he was dating. And I just was like, oh my God, on top of everything else that's so great and interesting about this band, this story is insane. And I was talking to my wife and just said, someone's got to make a documentary about this band. And she said, well, why don't you do it? And, I'm a TV comedy writer. I've never made a movie, but I just started thinking about it and it just seemed like, you know what? I think maybe I could do this. I had a mutual friend who I asked to connect me with Jeff and Steve, and I just sort of made my pitch to them. And I knew they had to take a chance on someone who didn't have a track record of, documentary filmmaking or anything. But, I think they saw that I was a genuine fan and coming from that place, and that I, even though, I had storytelling experience, I've been telling stories and writing for decades. And so, they said, all right, like, we'll do it. And next, from the beginning, I was like, it's going to be my version of your story. You guys don't get final cut or any say, really, but, you just have to trust me. And, they've been really happy with it.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. And you mentioned your background. I know that you're probably best known for your Emmy-winning work on Friends, the last three seasons of Friends.
The last
Have
seven.
you
Seven,
seven?
please. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. Yeah, so that is really impressive, but it doesn't really translate into documentary filmmaking. And you mentioned that this is your first one, but have you done anything professionally with music before this?
No, I'm just been a fan, I'm just a like rabid music fan, and I think what was really helpful is a sort of real consumer of music documentaries. So I've seen so many, and you learn a lot just by watching, tons of, in any genre that you're going to take on, it's good to be a genuine fan and having seen good and bad examples. And sometimes you learn more from the bad examples. But no, since my like, high school hardcore band, I don't think that counts. I have not recorded.
Probably not, but gives you some insights. Now, another recent documentary that comes to my mind about a quirky brother band is the Sparks Brothers. So I'm wondering, did you watch that film?
I mean, yes, I did watch that, and it's funny, there is a connection in that Steve McDonald played in Sparks for 5 years, but is not in that documentary, which he's
Yeah.
sort of, he was supposed to be interviewed, and they rescheduled, and he never did it, which is sort of a sore spot because I think they talked to some people who were in that band for shorter stretches than Steve, and somehow he didn't get in there. Look, there's a lot of cool stuff in that film, but the biggest influence it had on me was that movie. I think is like 2 hours and 20 or 2 hours and 25 minutes, and I don't like say I got bored, during it, and I just it was a point where I was like, I was already working on my film, and I was just like, I'm going to keep this movie under 90 minutes if it kills me, because the when a movie just overstays its welcome, and you have a band like Sparks, they've got a lot of the 20 something albums, you kind of don't need to cover everyone, but they felt they did. And I was just like, there's a certain point this becomes something just for the hardcore fans, and I didn't want to do that. So there are things that are left out of of the sort of theatrical cut of this film that I've had fans say, like, I can't believe you didn't put in this. And I'm just like, there'll be special features on the DVD, but I wanted this movie to work for people that don't know this band. And so I wanted to keep it tight. And I just wanted it to be like, you never get bored. It's a fun ride the whole way through. And if I've left you wanting more, like, that's great. So, but this, Sparks are definitely a band where, it's two brothers and two very different brothers, and they play different sort of roles in the band. And I guess both bands could be kind of like considered cult bands. But even though I think Red Cross's music is eminently more accessible to people than Sparks. But yeah, no, I certainly watched that film, and I was very sort of heartened by the fact that it did well. That movie really did well and reached a lot of people. Now, you did have a kind of celebrity director, which really helped with that film. But for sure, I saw it.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on your approach. I also directed a music documentary, and it's about the Ventures, who's my dad. He started that band,
Oh,
and
wow.
they
Cool.
started in the early 60s. But my documentary is also only an hour and a half. I do agree with you that sometimes they can overstay their welcome when you
You couldn't cover every venture
add
track.
everything. Yeah, it's too much. But how long did it take for you to film and edit Born Innocent from start to finish? Because I know sometimes documentaries can take many years.
It did. I mean, so it took 9 years, and I just sort of recently found the like initial agreement with Jeff and Steve, and I think it was signed in September 2015. But it's a little bit misleading in a way, because when I started in 2015, but just filming a little bit here and there, I was still very much working as a TV writer, running shows during that period. And so it was just like, when I could, when there was a cool concert that maybe they were doing, I would try and film that. And I filmed an interview or two, but it was very piecemeal. And at a certain point, I guess it was probably in 2019, I just decided, so at that point I've been kind of working on it off and on for like 4 years, but didn't have a ton really to show for it. I just sort of said, at this rate, this is going to take 50 years to make. And at that point, I decided to do a Kickstarter, crowdfunding campaign, and decided if I make, if I hit my number and make this money, then I will really commit to doing this. And I did, and I got that money, and that's when I really like filmed most of the, sort of supporting interviews, all the talking heads, all the other musicians and band members and family members, and filmed more with the guys. And it was a much more concentrated period of working on it. And I finished up, most of the interviews that I wanted to get to right before the pandemic hit. And then that slowed things down too, just in terms of, being able to work with an editor, and, just obviously psychologically for all of us, it was just like a tough time. It wasn't a time where most people were being like at their most productive, myself included. But I did take that time, transcribe all the interviews and start to try and piece this thing together. It's a massive story to tell. This band has been together for 45 years, and there's not, like with some stories, there's a really clear trajectory because it leads up to like a death or whatever.
Right.
In the case, this band is playing in Europe as we speak, so just kind of figuring out how to structure it. And what it really was just sort of putting the story together, working all the sound bites together in a kind of chronological order, and then just ruthlessly shaving parts of it out. Just like, okay, that initial cut would have been, 6 hours or something like that. I think I only pieced together like two thirds of it, and it was about a 4.5 hour cut. And it was just like, okay, let's start putting the good parts of it closer together by getting rid of, the stuff that's less interesting. Or, but I really had to learn by doing it. I think if I were, and I don't know if I'll ever make another one of these, but it would go quicker. I know so much more about how to do it than I did going in. I really didn't know what I was doing. But you figure it out, you learn by doing sometimes.
Yes, making a documentary is quite different from a scripted or narrative Project.
Yeah.
Another thing that documentaries, especially music documentaries, can be very frustrating with is the issues and challenges in securing music rights and clearances needed for the archival footage and the recordings. Did you have that same issue, or did the
Oh my.
brothers own all the rights to their stuff?
No, I mean, it's such an issue. I mean, they own the rights to a good portion of their catalog at this point, which is great, but not all of it. So you do have to deal with, major labels on both the publishing and the master recording side, and that's, that's tough. But there's also, without fair use laws, you wouldn't be able to really make documentaries like
Right, that's so true.
that you are able to use certain things if basically, if someone in the film is talking about something, you can then show a clip of that thing they're talking about. And, there are certain parameters about how much you can use, but they're not clear parameters. They're just kind of a fair use lawyer kind of feeling like, I think that's like, I think you're okay there, or it's off. It's just kind of, but you really, I had to become this sort of fair use expert to figure out how to do this without, I did get Kickstarter money, which covered production, but then the rest of it really was self-funding. And you can't do it if you're having to pay to license all of the stuff you're using. But you have to figure out how to cut in such a way where you bring things into fair use. And so much of my time was spent on those issues, like just figuring out how to make it. Do I have someone saying something that I could use here, which would then make me able to use this clip under fair use? And boy, I mean, it's if anyone who's thinking about making a music documentary, that's going to become a big part of your job, is
Yes, true.
becoming an expert in fair use.
All right, well, I want to get to something a little more fun now. Red Cross, they do ha hail from Hawthorne, California. I used to live in San Pedro, so I know where that is quite well. How much do you think that that specific place and local scene and era affected or shaped their sound, especially in the early years?
I mean, I do think, there's obviously this cool thing, which is that the Beach Boys are the most famous band out of Hawthorne. Also a band of brothers, which is, Be True to Your School and the Red Cross song I Hate My School are both written about Hawthorne High. So I think it shaped them in so many sort of interesting ways. I think the time and place. They're in this town that's near Los Angeles, but kind of a world away from it, especially when you're little. Like, there was no real easy way to get into, Hollywood or LA proper from the South Bay. You're in this very sort of conformist beach culture town. And I think that's how they started, just skateboarding and, going to the beach and wearing their OP. But the fact that Jeff, for whatever reason, as the older brother, was able to very early on discover the Ramones, the Runaways before that, and the Ramones, and then through that, the early LA punk scene, that he would like ride his moped from Hawthorne into Hollywood, to go see the Go-Go's and the Weirdos and, the Germs. And I mean, it's insane if you know the geography of riding your moped as a kid in those two points. But the fact that, they were huge music fans, and they were, Jeff was saw the Beatles when he was like 2 or 3 years old. He doesn't really remember much of it other than the screaming, and he fell asleep. But they were huge Beatles fan. From the time he could talk, he was a fan of the Beatles and a fan of music. And they were going to these arena shows at the Forum to see Kiss and Rod Stewart and I can't remember if they saw Zeppelin or not, but to see those big arena. So they were very into rock and roll and practicing their moves in the mirror, before they could even play any instrument. And then they were lucky that the Ramones did come along when they did, which really just told them the combination of the Runaways being really young and the Ramones being very simple made them think, you know what, we can do this. Like, it's what punk rock did for so many people. It made it feel possible, and accessible to just learn a few chords and start banging away. And so that's what they did. And so it's, and then it just so happens that they saw that this band, this new band, Black Flag, were in a neighboring town, and they were ambitious enough that they figured out how to track them down and made that connection and sort of played, their few songs they had in front of Black Flag. And Black Flag, who didn't, were just starting out, didn't have any real following or friends, were just like, okay, cool, why don't you guys open for us? And so they just happened to be there at that moment. I don't, when people, I don't love when people call this like a punk doc, a punk rock documentary, because they did start in that scene and they have a punk rock spirit that is carried through, but they're not really a punk band the way a lot of people think of them. They evolved into much more,
Oh, there's a lot of melody and
There's so much
intelligent
more.
lyrics and humor.
But punk rock made it possible for them to just sort of start. It gave them a starting place. And they actually did their first record, which is, is really a punk rock record. I mean, this, you can see the nascent songwriting ability, and these are fun pop songs, and you could tell they were listening to both the Ramones and watching Annette Funicello beach movies and taking stuff from that music. And there's Henry Mancini is in there, and their first real sort of hit song, Annette's Got the Hits, is kind of Peter Gunn by Henry Mancini. And so they I think that place and that time of being, like a lot of 70s kids, like raised by TV and reruns and all this kind of HR Puffin stuff, kind of stuff that they were watching that they decided to bring into their aesthetic and their music. There's a real Gen X kind of mashup of influences in the stew that is Red Cross.
Absolutely. One of the legendary moments covered in your film is that David Bowie apparently came to Red Cross's very first nightclub show. And do you know if the McDonald's brothers were aware that Bowie was in the audience while they were playing that night, or did they
They
find out afterwards?
found out afterwards. They didn't know. It was people, and there's still uncertainty whether like he saw the show, or the Hong Kong Cafe where they played that show had a couple different areas. Like, there are some people that think no, he was there, he watched Black Flag and he watched Red Cross. But there's, it's one of these frustrating things where there's the recollect, they're very clear recollections of some people that were there and saw him and know he was there. And I did, one of the great sort of, you making these things, you also have to be a bit of an archaeologist, because you're just trying to track down old VHS tapes and photos and wherever wherever they might be lurking. And one of the coolest discoveries was Greg Hetson, who was in the original lineup of the band and then went on to form the Circle Jerks and was in Bad Religion. And anyway, I pretty far into the process, I asked him if he had like a high school graduation photo or something that I could use for a part of the film where I was talking about him. And he was in high school at the time, and he's like, he sent me one, but he's also like, I think my dad came to our first show and he took a bunch of color slides. And I think they're in a box somewhere. Do you want me to find that? And I was just like, oh my God, yes. It took a while for him to dig them up and then to scan them. And but there are these amazing, photographs in color of that show. And you see how little Steve McDonald was. And I was just like, this is so great. This is incredible. These haven't been seen, and it's such a cool thing to have in the film. But I was like, would it have killed your dad to have gotten a shot of David Bowie? Like, he could have just sort of like turned and, but maybe Greg's dad didn't know who the hell that was. It was still a, like, it's likely that an adult, like, at that point could easily not have, from Hawthorne, like, wouldn't have known who Bowie
Oh,
was.
absolutely.
Oh my God, if that had been in there, and, I'm like searching these photos to see, and I'm like, and there's some cool things. There's like, okay, there's Chuck Dukowski from Black Flag is in the front row, and you do find, but like, no photographic evidence of Bowie, unfortunately.
So it remains a legend.
Yep.
Well, you touched on this earlier, Born Innocent reveals that as a 13-year-old, bassist Stephen McDonald briefly ran away with a pregnant older woman named Dee. Now, I understand that Dee died at a relatively young age, but I was unclear when watching the film as to whether or not she had the baby. But I do understand that there were no criminal charges filed against her. Now, do you feel that that's a reflection of the era, the parenting, or?
Yeah, I know. I guess it is the sort of true crime of the film, if there is one. Well, let's see. To take the first part of that question first, the pregnancy. She told, I don't want to tell too much of the story because I do want people to see it, but she did tell him she was pregnant, and she kind of held it over his head and sort of said she would get an abortion if he would run away with her, to the point where this 13-year-old kid felt he had really no choice. There is no way of knowing whether she ever actually was pregnant. My suspicion is she never was, and that this was a manipulation. She was a real sort of sociopathic manipulator. And at the point where he's trying to end this relationship with her and she's desperate to keep it going, I think she made that up. He, in terms of, she did say at some point she like went to a clinic, and but there's no way to know. So there's really, certainly she did not have the baby. The question is really, was there even a pregnancy at all? And we'll never know. I think, I mean, the story is kind of an incredible story, regardless of the time that it took place. But I think it does sort of touch on something about that era, which is like, certainly in the other, with the genders reversed in terms of older guys dating very, very young girls, 13, 14-year-old girls, that was quite common and largely accepted. It happened a bit in the other direction as well. I don't think it was super common, but I definitely think there were older women. There were more than, just the older women on that scene who were dating, younger guys. It was thought of as like a little unusual by the friend group when they got together, when Steve and Dee got together, but not like absolutely insane and like not looked at at all the way it would be looked at today. I think people were just like, okay, that's, that's a couple that in some way like is a slightly unusual, but kind of makes sense, whatever. No one's like seemed to be that freaked out about it, other than Steve's parents when they found out. They found, I don't think this isn't in the film, but the way they found out was like they did read some journals, that he'd been keeping, and found evidence, because he had been saying, oh, we're just friends, and they certainly were like, this is wrong, like this is not okay, you have to end this. Like they said, you cannot see her. I think a lot of people, when they hear sort of some of the just broad strokes of the story, think, oh, they must have been these typical kind of latchkey kids where the parents were really neglectful. Not the case at all. Like the parents were really good parents. I mean, they're 70s parents, so they're not like parents of today who are just so in their kids' business all the time. No one really was that way back then. But by the standards of the time, they were really good parents. I don't think they totally understood this punk rock fascination, but they drove Jeff and Steve to shows. They would drive them to the Whiskey in Hollywood. They drove them to the famous Elks Lodge riot show in like MacArthur Park in downtown LA. So they were supporting this interest of their kids. They were proud when their, band got played on the radio, and they had a loving family situation. A lot of, which is unusual for that scene. That scene attracted a lot of runaways, a lot of people with really toxic home life. And Jeff and Steve were real exceptions in that they would go to these shows, and it's not like they were posers, like they were like part of that scene, but they got to go home to a very functional family life. So I don't think there's really any blame for what happened that can be put on the parents. You know, they were good parents.
I like that they're in the film too. That's a very interesting dimension and added layer to their backstory.
Because it is just sort of, it's just you're trying to be like, how did these two freaks come from these two salt of the earth, just normal as can be, you know, parents? Like they're Janet and Terry, the parents, they're great, but they're just really just kind of working class, very normal. And then they somehow produce these two weirdos, and it's really fascinating. But they're very close still. Like, and I just love, there's a grounding in reality that I think you get from just getting to really get to know the parents. You know, they're just good people.
I agree with you. And you also have the more standard interviewee types in Born Innocent. You've got some fascinating figures like Pleasant Gaiman, who's a rock journalist and a musician in her own right. You've got Sonic Youth's Thurston Moore, filmmaker Allison Anders. How did you go about assembling all those interviews and getting those people to participate?
Well, you know, I made my big list, and it's a really big list when you know, I sort of broke it down almost by era. I was like, okay, there's this sort of, you know, hardcore era. Like, here's who I'd want to talk to from Black Flag, and like, you know, and then okay, now there's this sort of more, you know, glammy era. Like, who do I? So there's a big list of people that played a part in their story. And I reached out to them in various ways. I will say that the band themselves, you know, Jeff and Steve, were probably the most helpful in connecting me with people. You know, that they're so sort of beloved by so many other musicians that, you know, sometimes it would take a while, but I'd say, hey, I want to talk to, you know, Thurston. They're like, okay, you know, and I would get a text like connecting me with Thurston, and then I would set it up, or, you know, Kim Gordon. Or, you know, and then in some cases it was just sort of cold calling, basically reaching out to people, following some chain, you know, that I gotta have Roman Coppola, you know, in the film, or it's like you're just following a chain of connections, and it's a lot of hard work. And when you make a film like this, it's not like, oh, I've got someone else who's like taking care of like some kind of booker who's, but no, this is like me, like every single one of these, putting it together, reaching out, scheduling, finding a place to do it. You know, and there were some, like I took a trip up to Seattle because the band was playing, and it was just like, okay, I, you know, talked to Kim Thayil from Soundgarden while I was up there, and I talked to the Fastbacks, and talked to Dave Dieterer from Presidents of the United States, who didn't make it into the final cut, but it was just like, okay, who can I get while I'm up in Seattle? But luckily, most of the people were LA based, which is where I'm based, so I could shoot, oh, you know, most everyone here, or I would, you know, like Mark Arm and Steve Turner from Mudhoney, like, you know, okay, I found out when they were going to be in town, and I grabbed an interview with them while they were in town, and that worked for, you know, for most of the people. Obviously, there were people on that list I just didn't, you know, for whatever reason, who didn't want to do it, or if I couldn't get to, or just couldn't make it happen. But, you know, I'm pretty pleased that like most of the members of the band I talked to, and you know, most of the people that were played some kind of significant role. I don't have a lot of just people there to just say, oh, Red Cross is so great. You know, rock critic kind of people who weren't there and are just there. Like, I didn't want to have a lot, very little of those people. Most of the people in the film are like they were witness to some stage of this story, whether that's, you know, Keith Morris, or, you know, Vicki Peterson from the Bangles, who dated Jeff, or Charlotte Caffey from the Go-Go's, who's married to Jeff now. Like, these are all people who aren't just in it because, like, oh, here's a famous face that I can get. It's just like they were part of the story and have some kind of first person witness that they can speak to.
And they happen to be famous faces, so win-win.
Yeah.
Well, I love the fact that Red Cross once covered a Cousin Serena song from the 1960s sitcom Bewitched, which many Gen Xers watched and reruns. What were some of the other examples of their more unusual and innovative music choices that you'd uncovered while making the documentary?
In the album before that, they cover a song by the Carrie Nations, who are the fake all-female band in Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which I, and there's also and they're less sort of proud of this now, I guess, but they also on that same record sort of a hidden track, which is a cover of Cease to Exist written by Charles Manson. Which, I don't think a lot of people at that point were really familiar with Manson's album, and his music. I mean that "Blow You a Kiss in the Wind," cover from Bewitched really was, it's on that record that I talked about as from Teen Babes from Monsanto, is just like that mashup of like they're covering the Stooges and Cousin Serena from Bewitched. Like what is going on here?
Great.
And as they went on, they didn't do it as many covers on the records, although they're always throwing in covers. They play a lot of Beatles covers that they talk about in the movie. They don't often just like do like side two of Sgt. Pepper's. And but the last time I saw them, they covered Crazy Horses by the Osmonds, which they had recorded in the past. And they played a few times, but it's just another one. It's just like, God, that's a great song. And it's just this really heavy rock song by the Osmonds. And they love it. And so it's just kind of like, because they love it, they're gonna throw it in there along with, their cover of Deuce by Kiss. But I think it's just, this combination. And it really started to become super evident on their Neurotica record, where there's still that Ramones influence, and it was produced by Tommy Ramone, but there are these sweet melodies in there, and I, as a listener, was hearing it. I couldn't figure out what all the influences were. I just knew like these are just like sort of such pleasing, melodic songs, but you're still without losing this grounding in punk rock and a little bit of they've always also been fans of like early Black Sabbath, and they love Live at Leeds by The Who, and there's a certain kind of heavy metal that they liked, and they loved Alice Cooper. I don't know if people would consider that really metal, but they're not a metal band by any stretch, but there are certain elements of the like what I think of as the best, parts of certainly early metal that are in there too. But they also like the Archies and the 1910 Fruit Gum Company and the Partridge Family, and that's in there. And so there's just the things they were mashing together, kind of intuitively. Is their drummer for a while, one of their drummers, many drummers, Victor Andrizzo, is just like, they were punk rock, and they were the Beatles, and they were Kiss, and it's like, yeah, they were kind of all those things simultaneously. And for the people that loved all those things and thought of them as separate, it was suddenly like, oh, here's a band that's doing putting it all together, and it's so much fun and just brings so much joy.
I feel like their ultimate strength in terms of their, I want to say, like their magpies taking different influences and putting them together. But that also makes them harder to pigeonhole, which might be why they're not a household name like some of their contemporaries. Do you feel
For sure.
that is
I
possible?
really feel that. I mean, I struggle like when I'm talking to people about this movie I made about this band, and they say like, "Well, what kind of band are they?" It's just like, "Oh boy, like how do I explain it?" There's no one label that really fits. So I do, start to say like, "Well, do you like the Do you like the Beatles? And do you like Cheap Trick? And do you like the Ramones? And do you know? And people start to get intrigued. Like, yeah, I like all those things. Like, well, you'll probably like them then. Like, they're ultimately just a great rock and roll band. Some people, you know, you see lots of stories that label them as a power pop band. It's like, yeah, that's in there. They're certainly they have some songs that I think you could call power pop. They're not to me. They're not like that's very reductive to call them a power pop band, just as it's very reductive to call them a punk band. Like, because I don't like to say it because I think people get a certain image or sound in their head when you say that, and it's just like, no, there are elements that are in there. I just end up saying, like, do you like rock and roll? Like, do you like rock music? Like, you're give them a chance. I bet you're gonna like a lot of this, especially, you know, once they hit the stage, like at Teen Babes and the records after that, where they really figured out how to play and write songs. You know, the early couple records are, you know, I love them. They're not going to be for everyone. And then, you know, of course, there are certain people, you know, their first sort of full length record, I guess, even though it's still very short, is called Born Innocent. And it's, you know, this kind of garagey punk song that does have covers of the Carrie Nations and but also has some, you know, song called like Kill Someone You Hate. And there are people that are just like they, you know, like Stephen Malkmus from Pavement is like, that record is one of the top my top 10 records of all time, and they never did anything good after that. And it's just like, okay, you know, that's, you know, you're entitled to your opinion. I strongly disagree, but there are some people that only want to like rep that phase of the band. But to me, it's just like they're all great, but I do really, you're right. They're magpies. They're like taking all these things, and it makes them hard to pigeonhole. It makes it not surprising that they're not a household name. I also think, you know, the moment where they would have had the biggest chance of becoming household names is, you know, the early 90s is that sort of Nirvana moment. You know, they had inspired Nirvana, they inspired, you know, all of pretty much all of those Seattle grunge bands. But you know, the music they were making at that time was very much, you know, not like that. And also those bands, when you think about Nirvana or Alice in Chains or Soundgarden, they're very angsty bands. They're very sort of open up and bleed. Here's all my pain. And Red Crosses have never been about that. Like, there's too much joy in there and happiness in their music. It's not sappy or anything, but there's like, you know, it's not angsty. Very rarely is it. And I think that's, you know, I think that was certainly a factor too. That's what people were looking for in their rock stars in that moment. And you weren't getting it, and you weren't getting a lot of really naked self, you know, revelation from Jeff in his songwriting. He has a different kind of take. It's a little bit inspired by, you know, he loves Bob Dylan, and there's like a, there's, you know, there's a, he likes his lyrics to be a bit mysterious and to take these little bits and pieces that, you know, if you ask him about it, you can find out where he's drawing them from, but they don't have very obvious interpretations, and that interpretation is definitely not like, here's how miserable I am, and let me tell you about it. Like, he's, you know, Jimmy's Fantasy, which is maybe the closest thing they had to a hit, which is just such a great song, is really, you know, it's about the song remains the same, and like Jimmy Page's fantasy sequence in that movie. And, you know, it's these very arcane kind of references. That's how he likes to often, not all the time, but it's like how he likes to write songs. That's not what the mainstream audience always wants.
Well, I hope that the documentary will open people's eyes and ears to their wonderful and varied music. I'm wondering what ultimately you hope viewers will take away from watching Born Innocent.
I mean, the goal was always to make new fans for this band. It really was just to like spread the gospel, and you know, it just felt to me like I don't think this, you know, is a band that is going to be Coldplay or something, but I don't think this is a band that should be playing small clubs. Like, this is a band that should have a bigger following. This is not obscure music. This is just music that so many people, if they were exposed to it, would really love. And so it was always just like, if I can get this band better known and introduce them to an audience that, there's been so many people that have said to me afterwards, like, I can't believe I didn't know about them. I'm just like, yeah, that's why I made it. Like, I can't believe you don't know about them either. Like, you should know this band. And they should, when I think about the fact that after that Sparks documentary we were talking about, that Sparks played the Hollywood Bowl, it's, because of that documentary, it's just like, that's, I don't know if that'll happen, but that's my dream. Like, that was the goal. Like, Red Cross would kill on the stage at the Hollywood Bowl. They're a band that's meant to play arenas. They know how to put on a great rock and roll show. They studied Kiss and all these bands at arenas, and they should be playing the bowl. So that's what success would look like. It's certainly not, I did not, it was a true labor of love. I like fully expect that at the end of the day, I will have lost money, on this, but that's it. If it really does make a whole new contingent of fans for this band, that's what success will look like. And I should add too that, like, I already feel like such a sense of accomplishment because this new double album that they put out, and the book which is out, were very much spurred by me making this film. Really, the start of this new album, I think, was just I asked them to write me a song for the end credits, an original song, and they wrote this song that is called Born Innocent. And that really spurred them to just start writing more, and they kind of got on a tear that ended up with this great double album. And they were very kind and thanked me on the record, and it's just, and they're acknowledging like that just the course of making this, doing these interviews and making this documentary really was a spark for that. And like that, just as a fan, it's just like, there's all this incredible, great new Red Cross music, like partly because of me, is amazing. Like, I already just feel like so great just about that.
That is fantastic, and it sounds like a dream come true. But now, Andrew, we're nearing the end, so I have to ask you my parting question on the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. What's your own personal rock and roll nightmare?
I mean, I guess it would be having to sit through a Grateful Dead show.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's a tough one.
Just feels like it would just be so, no matter how many people have tried to convince me that that is good music, like, I just cannot take it. And just having to be there with the crowd and to listen to that music for what is going to be hours and hours, like, I think that's my nightmare.
I recently saw the latest iteration of the Grateful Dead at the Sphere here in Las Vegas. And I must say that the fans were surprisingly uptight for being supposedly mellow hippies.
I guess you're at least in the. I did go see U2 at the Sphere, and that is such an incredible venue. So I
It
guess
is. There was that.
that would be less of a nightmare than just being in some big dusty field, with just like people all selling their tapes and like, that's the, when I envision the nightmare, it's not at the Sphere.
I want to know where people can watch, where and when can people watch Born Innocent? And is there a website for the documentary? And are you on social media and all that good stuff?
Yes, thank you for asking. The best place is to go to redcrossfilm.com, and keep in mind that it is REDDKROSS, source of much confusion over the last decades. Redcrossfilm.com. All of the upcoming screenings will be there with ticket links when they're live. You can also sign up for a mailing list where you can get updates. So that's the best place. We're also on social media. We're at Born Innocent Red Cross on most in most places. I know we're that's what we are on Instagram and Facebook and TikTok. So lots of, those are really fun to follow too, because we're just putting up lots of, great sort of artifacts, photos, flyers, it's a Red Cross ephemera that aren't in the film and aren't really, some which haven't been seen. So those, it's fun. And, once the screenings start to happen, those will be announced soon. But it all is going to kick off December 5th in LA at the Chinese theaters, will be the first official. We've played a bunch of festivals, about a dozen festivals or so, but the first sort of official theatrical screening will be December 5th, and then it'll kick off a bunch of cities from there. Hopefully coming to somewhere near you, wherever you are listening from. And then it will be, once we do that run, it'll live sort of exclusively at redcrossfilm.com for a while. You'll be able to rent or buy it there exclusively, for a period of time. And then, we'll see what happens from there. But yeah, that's the
Excellent.
plan.
Well, many chances to watch it and to discover the band. Thank you very much, Andrew, for helping introduce me to them. Their name was vaguely familiar to me, but now that I've listened to the music and seen the documentary, I'm a new fan, and thank you very much for being here.
Oh my gosh, that's like mission accomplished. That
Indeed.
makes me, just one person at a time. We're gonna make it happen. But that's awesome. Thank you so much. This is really fun. Thanks for all the great questions and for having me on. I really appreciate it.
This concludes another episode of the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. Remember, there's a book series too. All the books are available in paperback, ebook, and audio via Amazon or the Rock and Roll Nightmares website. That's ROCK-N-ROLL-Nightmares.com. Our official theme song is She's Out for Blood by Fuzzbuster, founded by Lars Cabot. Thank you for listening.
Well, she's by